My name is Vern Reiki. I haven't had the privilege of meeting all of you. I teach law at the University of Washington School of Law. And I'm engaged here in a series this week of lectures dealing, discussions more accurately, dealing with the problem of certain concepts or terms which are used by the church and which are used by the law, and we tend to scramble them in such a way that it debases both the functioning of our religion and of our law. I would like to address one of these this evening. Yesterday, we discussed the first of this group of five sins. We talked about the concept of justice. Starting there for two reasons, really. One reason is simply because the theme which has been selected for the discussions at Holden this year, as you all know, are gentle justice. The word gentle justice. And I'm asking whether or not that is a self-contradicting term. One of the pastors asked me today whether or not I thought it was oxymoron. And I said, I don't know, what does that mean? And it apparently is a word which means that two words used together make nonsense. And I said, well, give me an illustration. He says, well, how about military intelligence? I do not believe that gentle justice is a necessary contradiction in terms. I don't think it's oxymoron, whatever that word seems to mean. Rather, I think that it is, as with the other terms that I'll be talking about this week, that is to say, justice, tonight, constitutionality, tomorrow, the term covenant, which I regard as being the most dangerous of all the words that we use. The fourth one, authority, and the last one, community, or as you will see it on the blackboard up there, kingdom. I think those are very dangerous words. What I tried to point out yesterday, I thought might be reviewed most quickly by putting it in graphic form. And here I have the church, the state, or you can think of it as our faith, and the way we express our faith, the words that we use to express our faith, our law, and the way that we state our law, and then what I am choosing to call the muddled middle, the imprecision. And the illustration that I used of that yesterday was a very fine document written by the bishops of the Roman Catholic Church on the economy in the United States. In that, they based their argument primarily on the idea that God is just, therefore we must do what is just, and that is our criterion or our measure of what we must accomplish. And the words here that are important to me are that they see justice as being an absolute criterion, and they see that there is an obligation on our parts to do what is just. The dangerous words are absolute and obligation. I believe that they are right in saying that God is just. But I think that is a very carefully defined word as used in Scripture. I even believe that the term gentle justice is understandably descriptive of God. God is gentle. He also meets the measure. He is accurately described by the yardstick of being just. He keeps his word. He does what he says. God is faithful and just, and his mercy is absolute. It is enduring, and it is never coerced. God never compels a human being to accept his absolute, enduring offer of reconciliation. Rather, God has made us free. On the other hand, justice, as seen by the law, is a process. It is not absolute, and it is accompanied by coercion. It is a process because in a world which is fallen, and it's such a relief to have an audience where I don't have to stop and talk for a half an hour by what I read about fallen. We live in a world of imperfection, where things never come out right. As the wonderful story from Babel in Germany, everything has a crack. Rather, we must make terribly difficult decisions. I love the way that Ruth did that in the Bible study this morning. Tamar, this poor woman, caught by one of two choices, either one of which was forbidden by the law, and compelled to do one or the other. So we must make judgments, we must make decisions. And what we regard as being justice in the law is a process. We call it due process. And when the process has been observed, when both sides are heard, when the same rules are applied, when the rules are made known, and when the judges act in their best judgments, not being corrupt, then justice has been done. Although it is never perfect and never absolute, and we lawyers have a statement that we use usually just to ourselves because we don't like to cut other people in on this too often, and that is that although we are frequently in error, we are never in doubt. For the simple reason that any question which is truly a legal question is one which does not have a knowable answer. Any question which has an answer which can be found scientifically by weighing or measuring or chemical testing is not a lawyer's problem. A lawyer's problem is when there are two alternatives, neither one of which can be defined as being the ultimate, perfect, demonstrable, correct answer, but a decision must be made. Judges don't like that. You know, that's one reason why in the law of many states, such as in the law of the state of Washington, a judge who refuses to give an answer within so many days after the case has been submitted has his salary withheld until he makes the decision. How would you like to decide someone's future, perhaps the life of that person, on evidence which is incomplete and uncertain, testimony of persons whose veracity is in doubt? And you must decide. Law is a process. We call it due process. The consequences are not absolute, and we follow it with coercion. Justice Holmes says, law exists only in the end of a policeman's nightstick. Any right without a remedy is not a right. Now, in the middle of that, ladies and gentlemen, comes the letter from the Roman Catholic bishops, in which they say that it is the will of God that we act in certain ways, because that is just. And because some people will not act that way, it must be coerced by God. muddled, middle, serious, in my opinion, error, debasing both law and my Christian convictions. Now that was yesterday, and we can't take time to go all through that again. Maybe it wouldn't help if I did. Let me try again with another illustration. The word for tonight, the concept for tonight, is the nature of a human being. What is a human being, and how do we describe that, and how do we think of it? In the church, we say, God's Son has made me free. By creation, by covenant of God, and you can't understand what I mean by that until after tomorrow. Sorry about that. I've got to start someplace. Don't you ever, in my presence, think of covenant as a contract in which both sides have obligations or I will run right down your throat. A covenant is a one-way, unilateral promise. I bind myself by my own name, says the Lord. Not because you are able to give me something that I want in a bargain. We'll talk tomorrow about seals. Talk a little bit about seals today. Tomorrow we'll talk about covenants and about oaths. And what a hideous thing we have done with covenant and with oaths. Just one. Freedom, creation, covenant, that's absolute. God's love and his offer of reconciliation is enduring forever, never to be revoked. That's what the covenant is all about. But never coerced. God's Son has made me free. Constitutionally, we say that human beings have certain rights. We call them quite frequently human rights, and the Declaration of Independence of the United States, July 4, 1776, called them human rights. And just because we never read anything like that, somebody may think that's a term we've thought up recently. Human rights. Human rights by Constitution are given certain limited protections. There comes a time at which what you think of as your right to be protected, to have your life protected, not military service, you know. To have your liberty protected? Oh no. There are many instances in which we decide to take people's liberty away and put them in prison, but to deny them a right to be self-determining. Your property? I'm silly. Limited protection, not absolute, and always involving coercion. Do you follow what's going on here? In the middle, we have something that you all know about, and we coectus, novo, novus, ordo, sectorum. Please take from your billfolds a dollar bill. Please take down a bill. I'm not going to take up a collection. And if some of you don't have a dollar bill, share with your friends.
only a $1 bill
will do. On the back side of a $1 bill, you will see on the one side the obverse, that is the front, of the Great Seal of the United States. It has the familiar eagle, the shield with the stars and stripes and the arrows, 13 of them counting here. and so forth. You know, every time you want to listen to the president or anybody else that's in the rank of the secretary or above, he's standing there with the obverse side. You ever wonder what it looked like from the back side?
Yeah.
This has got absolutely nothing to do with this. But to show you what an unreasonable woman I managed to live with for 40 years. One night I woke up and suddenly I was grabbed by an intense desire to know what the inside of your belly button looks like.
2 o'clock in the morning.
2 o'clock in the morning.
A.M.
So I woke her up and asked her. She didn't think it was a reasonable question.
Not at 2 o'clock in the morning.
The reverse side of the Great Seal of the United States has a pyramid built of stone, and the top is not there. It's suspended and floating magically, as it were, above. It has an eye in the middle, a little wave is shooting around. And overhead it says Annali Coeptus, and underneath it says Novus Ordo Seclorum. Now there are undoubtedly people here who remember their Latin better than I, and I'll take a stab at it, and if you can do a better job of it, why, please help me. Annali Coeptus. Providence or God has directed or favored our undertaking. It is the wish of God, the power of God, that directs us in our undertaking as a nation. Novus Ordo Seclorum, to develop a new order for persons who live in the world, a new secular order of government. It was bound up with what we frequently call the early idea of manifest destiny. People left the foreign nations and came to the United States for the purpose here of carrying out God's will, to create under God's orders, God's directions, a new order for people of the world to live, driven by this manifest destiny. It was the destiny. It was manifest. Anyone could see it, that God meant for these people, the Puritans, Presbyterians, the Lutherans, and the rest of the world, to escape from the errors of their homeland and those early settlers, and to follow God's direction. A very modest statement it is indeed. We are God's agents to redo the secular order, the governmental structures of the world. I know of only one other nation in the world that makes that kind of noises. That's South Africa. Maybe some of you have read the Covenant. The belief in South Africa that they, the white population alone, are superior and are God's chosen people. I want to talk a little bit about that when we get to authority. I happen to have had the opportunity to appear several times in South Africa in legal trials on behalf of persons who were oppressed. I can't go there anymore. If someone has to be persona non grata somewhere, that's a good place to be persona non grata. But I would like to tell you a little bit about that experience when we get to the concept of authority, because it's meaningful to Christians. There is a larger proportion of the people in South Africa in church on Sunday morning than in any other nation of the world. So we have in the middle here, the muddled middle, the notion that God has issued orders which are to give us a system of government directed by God. Now we must do a quick history lesson of the United States, and then we must do a quick coverage of the course of constitutional law and get all of that over in about 16 or 17 minutes and talk about this problem as we must tonight. I've already mentioned to you that the Declaration of Independence was adopted by the Continental Congress on July 4th, 1776. That's what you celebrate every time this year when you start blowing things up. One of the statements that appears, second paragraph, Declaration of Independence, reads as follows. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. An unalienable right does not mean something that cannot be taken away from you. Of course, your life can be taken, your liberty can be taken, your property can be taken, your pursuit of happiness can be taken. It means that it cannot be given away by you without destroying your characteristics as a human being. If you are not alive, you are not a human being. If you do not have liberty to make your own determinations, your own judgments, if you are not free to say, to think, and to feel, you are not a human being. If you are not free to own property, that comes from the Constitution, not the Declaration. When they tried to write something constitutionally about pursuit of happiness, they gave up. Friendship's got to do exactly the same thing. Fraternity, equality, and so forth. When they got to fraternity, they gave up. They put in property too. So much easier. Unalienable rights means that a human being has these characteristics. They are the characteristics of humanity. That's what God created. Free, liberty, alive, life, management, stewardship, care of the earth, property. The Constitution gives us some limited rights. That statement, the reverse side of the Great Seal, is the muddled middle, ladies and gentlemen. It makes absolute what our law can only make conditional. It makes enduring what we can only do temporarily. It says it must be coerced because in a fallen world, non-coercion won't work. The Constitution of the United States was drafted by the first Congress, which met immediately after the adoption of the Declaration of Independence. They drafted for 11 years in order to get the Constitution. It was on May 14th, 1787. Only those of you who read the Constitution can understand what they were doing. Only then was the proposed Constitution of the United States submitted for ratification by the states. The ratification process went on from the 7th of December 1787, Delaware being the first state to ratify. It was finally completed on May 29th of 1790, the last state being Rhode Island. Rhode Island missed most of the draft concessions, and they had to get some extra hours of study in. The Constitution was enacted only after Congress had guaranteed that there would be a Bill of Rights to accompany the Constitution. The Bill of Rights, at one time, had been thought of as being part of the Constitution, but that idea was abandoned because it would take longer to re-educate everyone, and the first 10 amendments have some arguable ideas in there. And they needed a unanimous vote of the states, at least 9, in order to form a union. Could have had a union of 9 states, 10 states, 11 states, 12, or 13. Got 13. To have put the Bill of Rights in would have defeated the notion of getting a unanimous vote. Congress, proposing the Bill of Rights, said it needs only a majority votes now that we've formed the union. Maybe the LCA and the ALC want to go ahead and merge and then argue about the details. That's what Congress did with the adoption of the Bill of Rights. Now, the Bill of Rights then proposed a number of things, and I want to call your attention to 3 which are most important to us. Article 4 of the Constitution itself says, the Constitution and the laws of the United States which shall be made in pursuance thereof, and all treaties made, which shall be made under the authority of the United States, shall be the supreme law of the land. And the judges in every state shall be bound thereby. Anything in the constitutional laws of any state to the contrary, notwithstanding the supremacy of the federal law over the state laws. The First Amendment, which is the important one for us tonight, Congress shall make no laws Congress shall make no laws respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof, or abridging the freedom of speech, or the press, or the right to assemble. There is only one place in the Constitution of the United States, or in the Bill of Rights, or the amendments, where both sides of a particular right are guaranteed. That's the religion clauses. Congress shall make no law establishing a religion. Congress shall make no law denying the free exercise of religion, both sides of it. Notice that in the First Amendment you get reference to the religion clauses and also to the freedom of speech. Do you think that the freedom of speech test is part of the religion clauses protection? You don't have to answer now. The Fifth Amendment, last portion of the last sentence, no person shall be deprived of life, liberty, or property without due process of law. That's the due process clause. And we've talked about that. You're all red hot on that subject. The 14th Amendment, you see, is not part of the original 10 amendments, the Bill of Rights. 14th Amendment was adopted at the time of, just after the Civil War, the Reconstruction period, and was ratified by most states fairly promptly. Georgia didn't get around to it until the Second World War, incidentally. But you can have an amendment to the federal constitution now by a majority vote of the states, so here we go. It says, no state shall make or enforce any law which shall abridge the privileges or immunities of the citizens of the United States, nor shall any state, I emphasize that because the original bill applied only to laws of Congress. States wanted to have their way to do what they like. Now comes the 14th Amendment, those immediately following, which says, no state shall enact a statute which deprives any person of life, liberty, or property without due process of law, nor shall any state adopt a statute which denies any person within its jurisdiction the equal protection of the law. So now we've got the religion clauses, we've got free speech, we've got due process, and we have equal protection. Those are all familiar terms to you, are they not? even if you don't know what they mean. Neither does anyone else, of course. The Constitution for purposes of the United States Supreme Court is written fresh each morning. It is a living document. It is applied contextually. It is a process for determining what is useful, what has utility, what meets the needs of the nation in that day, in that world, at that time. It is not absolute. It is, it's over there, it's not over there. And God forbid that we should ever muddle it in the middle. That's going to be my speech tonight. Now, should the church be able to implement its objectives through the law of the land? I go back for one moment to yesterday's discussion. We say that we separate the church and the state. Now you get the world's fastest course on constitutional law by looking very quickly at a few of the United States Supreme Court decisions, at which time you will all be masters of constitutional technique, and I will subject you to rigid cross-examination by giving you two recent decisions without the answers. You will answer the way that the case should be decided and explain why, basing your discussion upon your deep learning of constitutional law. What? Okay. Emerson against the Board of Education, 1947. A state statute may constitutionally provide transportation for all school children, for private and public schools, because it is a service given to the child, not to the schools, and it does not violate the Establishment Clause. It does not establish a religion. It helps kids. Nothing to it. Shooting fish in a barrel. McCollum against Board of Education, 1948. It is unconstitutional for a public school to make school rooms available for a religious group, but not to other groups that wish to meet in the school and use its rooms. Why? Hold your hat. Violation of equal protection. Nobody said establishment as of 1948. Sherbert against Turner, 1963. A statute which denies employment compensation to a worker who refused to work on Saturday, the Sabbath, violates, yes, free exercise, thank you, give a man a cigar. It violates the free exercise because it makes this person choose between observing his religious traditions or losing his job. Violates free exercise. Now you've got establishment, you've got equal protection, you've got free exercise, you are fast learners. School district against Schenck, 1963, said some very important things. It said that the Establishment Clause is absolute. No public support to establish a religion, but the Free Exercise Clause is always balanced because what I believe, establishment, my religion, but when I start acting out, my freedom to act must be balanced against your freedom not to have me act. My privilege to swing my fist, as the lawyers say, ends where your nose begins. I don't know how you feel about having people offering you flowers and books and so forth and yelling in your ear every time you go on an airfield. Where does the right of free action, free exercise, impinge so thoroughly upon somebody else's right not to be acted upon that the balance shifts and the constitutional protection to free exercise is lost. Not absolute, limited protection. And ultimately, if the guy persists when doing something he's not supposed to do, you put him in the can. Of course, I hope I'm not boring you silly by repeating something that you've thoroughly gotten in hand. But what a diametric departure from what the church teaches. Lemon against Kurtzman, 1971, very important text. It said, in order to be valid and not violate the religion clauses, three things must be apparent. One, the statute must have a legitimate secular purpose. Educate children, take care of the ill, you know, something that government ought to do. Secondly, the principle or the primary purpose must neither advance nor inhibit the practice of religion. Neither. Be neutral. Legitimate secular purpose. Neutrality. Thirdly, the implementation of the statute must not involve the government in magic words, excessive entanglement with the religious group. Very important case. Women against Kurtzman. Woman against Estes. A state decided to give tuition reimbursement to only non-public schools. Any problem with that? No children who are charged tuition. The state will reimburse the tuition for private schools, but not for public schools. Well, public schools don't charge their tuition. How could you? Any problem with that statute? I don't break my heart. You're doing so well. Equal protection. Equal protection is a problem. Any other establishment is a problem. If those private schools out there are parochial schools, possibilities of establishment, you get the possibility of equal protection. Hunt v. McNair, 1973, statutes permitting the issue of, like municipal bonds, revenue bonds, to build college buildings for private as well as public schools, private as well as public schools. Any problem? Say no. The Committee for Public Education and Religious Liberty, don't you love that name, against Nyquist. 1973, a statute which provided tuition for private schools only, you already know, invalid. The nice thing about this one is that it puts it squarely on the establishment grounds and no ambiguity about that. Bramer against Board of Public Works, state grants to both sectarian and non-sectarian colleges. Or building buildings. Valid, invalid. Valid, invalid. Nice guess. And accurate. And notice that it's different from transportation and school bus a few years earlier. Why? Because we're beginning to develop some sensitivity about how far you can go in helping churches before it becomes invasive of the governmental function and vice versa. Mm-hmm. Thomas against Review Board, a statute denied unemployment payments to one who was fired for refusal to work on military weapons. He said that his religion made it impossible for him to work on weapons of war. The statute denied unemployment insurance. This was a person who quit work because he couldn't work on weapons. The statute says you can't have it. Valid or invalid?
Valid.
Inbound. Free exercise, right to see, invalid. The statute cannot deny him that protection. He has the right to be protected in his religious belief, his conviction. Whitmore against Vincent, and I've got too many cases, but this is an important one, and I want to talk to you about it for a moment. The University of Missouri at Kansas refused to permit religious groups to conduct worship exercises in its classrooms. Nobody else around. It permitted the Rotarians to come in and do what they do, and the Lions to come in and roar, and other people to use, but they said no religious group may come in here. They might pray or sing a hymn. Is that a valid determination enactment by the Board of Trustees of the College of Regents, or is their action by state following members and the Regents of the State University? Is that valid or invalid? Invalid, yes. And now we come to sort of a fascinating discussion by the court, and we can't talk about it for more than just a moment. Invalid because it denies equal protection and also does not violate the religious clauses. Words, says the majority, are not acts. They do not violate somebody else's liberty. It isn't a free exercise. Words are not actions. Sticks and stones may make my home. The words were ever here to hurt me. You believe that? I want to talk to you about a bridge that I got to sell after. But a dissent, an interesting dissent, by Mr. Justice White, who says that words of worship are verbal acts, and they are not protected speech. Words of worship are verbal actions. When you pray, is that action? Or are you just talking about God? White says, you're acting. You're not just thinking. You're acting. And White says, religion must have its integrity protected by recognizing that for a worshiper of almost any faith who goes through the accustomed ritual of his faith, he is not just talking about it, he's doing it. And doing is action. Talking about is not action. All right? That's the minority opinion, you understand. And then a whole bunch of other fascinating cases which I can't talk about tonight because time for examination has come. In the state of Washington, a few years ago, there was a man who had impaired eyesight and another problem or so. So that he was not as easy to trade for a job and to become employed, as many folks are. The state of Washington at that time, since has repealed the statute, but at that time had some money available to be used for the purpose of providing occupational or other education for people who had disabilities. And this included and was often used to provide tuition and costs for sending people to schools or colleges to get an education so they could get a job. Mr. Witter applied for such a grant from the Department of Social and Health Services, and he passed all of the requirements. He was physically impaired. You know, everything was right the way the statute provided. And they said to him, yes, you qualify for this. What are you going to do? And he said, I'm going to university, went to Whitman College, Whitman College over in Spokane, at a nomination school, essentially. And they said, oh, that's fine, that's a good school. What are you going to study? He said, well, I'm going to become either a missionary or a parish worker or perhaps a pastor. And the school said, well, wait a minute. I want to go down and talk to my lawyer. You're a lawyer. State, give Mr. Ware the money, you're advising him. Or does not give him the money. Violation of the establishment clause. Anybody want to represent Mr. Witter in this matter?
Well, now, here's the way the state can't reach courses other students take that they give them money to.
Well, they don't. The state says we don't care too much about that. But when it's an exercise of religion, when it's an establishment problem, we cannot spend the money for that. The Constitution is prohibited.
He's giving them equal protection.
Equal protection. Would you also say free exercise?
Yes.
If you say free exercise and equal protection, see, equal protection and free exercise both. As you know, of course, because I just told you, as you know, those are balancing rights. Equal protection and free exercise must be measured against what it does to other people. It's limited, conditional, not absolute. Establishment, however, is an absolute prohibition. The state shall not establish. Does that make a difference to anybody in this constitutional problem? Mm-hmm. In fact, go to law school sometime and have this happen to you for 3 bloody years. Day after day, hour after hour. No wonder that comes out.
How do you do that when you said you don't want to end up something?
Yes, I know what you mean. Remember, in the law, there are no absolute answers. There are judgments, opinions, decisions, frequently in error, never in doubt. Disciples. Yes?
Why wouldn't the man take his case to a common law court, head law court, instead of equity court?
He was in the court of general jurisdiction of Washington. That is the common law and statutory court.
What did the jury say?
Well, I'm waiting juries out there. Well, you heard impassioned arguments on one side.
Well, they couldn't make
violation of the statute, the other side saying violation of equal protection and free exercise. You are now the Supreme Court of the state of Washington. What is your decision? Remember, when you decide the case, you must also give your reasons. No court may ever give a decision without its reason. That's for the guidance of everybody else. Those of you who believe that this decision not to provide the money is violative of Mr. Witter's constitutionally protected rights, please raise your hand. Those of you who believe that it is a constitutionally valid determination by the state, please raise your hand. I am sorry, ladies and gentlemen, the one thing you may not do is not vote. You do not vote, your salary is withheld. You are judges of the state of Washington. You have taken an oath, and you will truly and faithfully, and the best of your ability, decide the case. Now, and if you do not, I will come around with the electric cord. I can't record yourself. How many of you believe this statute is unconstitutional? how many of you believe that it is a constitutional proper use of the authority of the state of Washington?
We need to restate that for, I think we could get.
We have a determination by the state that denies the use of money to Mr. Witter. Mr. Witter says you are denying my right to free exercise and my right to legal protection. The state says no, what we are doing is constitutionally proper. Witter says it is constitutionally improper, wrong. How many of you believe that Mr. Witter is correct, that the state acted wrongfully in denying him the money? 14, 16, how many of you are in opposition? Well, that's pretty cute. In your instance, you find the statute unconstitutional. Presumably because you believe the free exercise equal protection is more persuasive than the establishment clause.
He also met the conditions, didn't he?
Oh, he met the conditions. Had he wanted to be a husbandryman or a veterinarian or even a lawyer, he would have had the money. But because the money was to be used in a way which would benefit a religious organization, it's indirect. Well, of course, it benefits a religious education. Anytime anybody goes to school and learns how to read and write, they're on their way to being a person and ultimately, or a parish worker, or even just a good Lutheran. The state is supporting you, you know. But the state Supreme Court of the state of Washington says the Constitution statute is valid. The DSHS acted properly in denying the money. Mr. Witter took an appeal to the United States Supreme Court. What did the United States Supreme Court decide? Do you vote the same way? Or has your confidence been shaken? About a month and a half ago, some of you undoubtedly read about the newspapers, the United States Supreme Court told the United States Supreme Court of Washington that they were in error.
You like that.
Footnote, and then we'll go on to the second half of the The Constitution of the State of Washington is more prohibitive than that of the Constitution of the United States. That is, it is narrower in the valid uses of money for religious related purposes than is the Constitution of the United States. More stringently drafted, are you with me? It's easier to define things unconstitutional as a violation of the religious mixing of church and state, of the Washington Constitution, than it is under the federal Constitution. May the state court of Washington now, they carefully avoided using the state statute in their first decision. They put it only in the federal Constitution. And lost, they got reversed. May they now say, but under the Constitution of the State of Washington, it was a proper determination not to give you the money quickly, finally.
Yes.
That's a good answer. I heard yeses and no. The Supremacy Clause. Oh, interesting. Someday when we've got lots of time, I'll tell you about the history of that is. Federal government in the Admission Act in the state of Washington said you've got to be more certain about the protection against mixing church and state than we are in the federal Constitution. You spell it out in more precise terms. The first draft of Washington's Constitution said copied that in the federal Constitution. The Fed said that's not good enough. We made it more stringent. The Fed said that's still not good enough. We really want people protected from mixing church and state. The third time we came back with this ultra stringent test, you still feel it's not going to be valid if the state of Washington is there? And you don't have to answer that. Second case, an army officer, a psychologist, an observant Jew, a rabbi, although not then acting as a rabbi, in the military service, wore to his work the yarmulke on his head, observing the fact that of his respect to God at all times, his head covered at all times. He could have worn civilian clothing and worn the color of his head, but he was told by the officials in the military that the rules of the army said that when an army officer is inside the building, unless he's a military policeman, he may not wear anything on his head. Why? Well, because we've got uniform. We've got uniform rules. And there's lots of things that you can do outside that you can't do in the army. And he said, but it is my religious, an act of worship for me in my religion to cover my head at all times. And they said, take your hat off when you're indoors. And he said, I will not. They said, you're in violation of the law. We'll court-martial you. And he said, the heck you will, and they did. So they did. They court-martialed him. And he, well, they didn't quite court-martial him. They began the process, and he brought an action in the federal district court. That's the whole federal courts and jurisdiction of the federal system, to enjoin, that is to stop, the enforcement of the rule. May I hear argument as to the constitutionality of the determination by the Army that he could not observe his religious practices? Yes, sir?
No, I'm in my mind because he voluntarily submitted to the equity jurisdiction, as an open jurisdiction of the Army. So once he did that, he was in hot water.
All right, I will then change my facts. You got the facts correctly, but I'm going to change the facts just a little bit. We've got a draft. Now he has no choice. He must serve. Yes, sir?
He's not acting as a rabbi.
Not acting as a rabbi, he's an observant Jew. I'm not a pastor, I'm a Lutheran. I like to observe my religious customs, and I would like not to have my free exercise thereof impaired by some oxymoron military. I'm sorry. I'm getting angry in national security, there are lots of things that you do in the military that you don't necessarily like to do and which you've got to do. Ask the guy who's been there, I know that. And the national security gives the Army immense powers. But does it give them the power to make a person not worship in the way that he wishes to worship? Is this an establishment problem or is this a free exercise problem? Free exercise. Is free exercise absolute or is free exercise conditioned? It is conditioned. What is it conditioned upon? What's the balancing? Yes. Does this act of worship so badly impair the well-being of the society in the United States that means the interest of the United States just overwhelms and crushes this religious observance? Who gets to decide that?
Well, the thing that he's seeking remedy in his own court, because he goes to equity court here.
No. He's in the general courts of general jurisdiction, federal courts. He ultimately gets to the United States Supreme Court.
This probably wouldn't be applicable, but I know of an instance where the Jewish religion allows them through great federal law all the time the slaughter of cattle. All everybody else has to go by, they render the cattle insensible before they kill them, but the Jewish law allows them to
You're a natural lawyer, sir. When you got a problem you don't want to decide, you want to talk about another. It's an analogy. Law works that way by analogies. What did we do? You like to be somewhat consistent. But you've got to decide my case, I'm sorry. And you've got to do it in 1 minute because then you have to go to bed.
Well, the military must be named Johnny. It must have authority. And
regulating uniforms, you do right exercise of authority in the whole system of the military is going to fall apart if you don't exercise.
If this gentleman works in Yamoka and his work as a psychiatrist, the Russians will certainly override. Do you all believe that? Law and order.
Well, you're a hard group.
Are you moving? Law and order types.
That's the way they have to run there. That's just the way they are.
So you mean a person who enters the army is denied his constitutional protected rights?
Oh, no.
Just because you happen to go to the University of Washington, you are not denied your rights constitutionally. Just because you happen to be in prison, you are not denied your basic human rights constitutionally protected. Just because you happen to be in the military, or even if you were married to Jane, you wouldn't be denied your basic human protected rights. All right, we got to go to chapel and take a vote. And you haven't thought you got a vote? Sorry about this. Question is whether or not that order of the federal government was constitutionally inappropriate. Those who feel that it is constitutionally invalid, that free exercise here is more important, and I say that to you without derailing all your thinking, that it's more important to do free exercise than it is to prevent establishment overturning the authority of the army. You will vote that the Constitution with the statute is invalid. Those of you who believe that this gentleman ought to have his right to observe his own worship forms protected will say that the use is unconstitutional. Those of you who believe that it's a constitutional proper use of power, put up your hand. 1, 2, 3, 4.
Yes.
Those of you who believe it's unconstitutional,
no.
You lose. You're wrong on that one. It is constitutional. Denial of free exercise. And you have to be believed. Now we must quit one more sentence, only this. Have I made any sense for you, if I hope, of the notion that to confuse a system of absolutes free of coercion, God never demands that the threat of punishment.